the better part of 20 years later. So it was like a return to home for me. You know, I pretty much started my career with Mike, and he gave me this amazing opportunity. And then almost 20 years later, he gives me the same opportunity all over again. So they say lightning doesn't strike twice, but it did in a good way this time. And the site, when he first called me and said he had a site in central Wisconsin, I did kind of scratch my head. You know, he's got a penchant for sand and sea, and I didn't think Wisconsin had sand, and I was pretty sure it didn't have any sea. So I couldn't quite figure out why I was headed to Wisconsin. But once I actually got on the site and I saw these giant sand dunes in the middle of the United States, I could see why he was enthralled by it. When you're wandering around every ridge top you crest, you expect to see a large body of water on the other side, but it never quite happened.
Well, I know that, it was a pretty interesting story to begin with. When Mike was first asked to take a look at the site, he sent Josh Lesnick out there to and said, give me a reason to say no to this place. And Josh called him back and said, I think you better come look at it. And once you got a chance to get out there and look at it, I'm sure you realized you had something to work with. You know, I've talked with a few golf architects over the years, and sometimes they say the property can only be as good as the land you've got to work with, but when you got there, you had to be pretty excited about what you found.
Well, I got there before Mike had bought the land, so probably just a few weeks or a couple months after Josh, before Bill and Ben got hired to do the first course. And so I was obviously thrilled, and I thought I had my nose slightly in front of the pack to do the first course. And it was Christmas Eve of, I think, 14, that Mike called me and said, hey, Merry Christmas, and P.S., I hired Curran Crenshaw to do the first course. So I was excited and then immediately deflated. And then when the first course got underway, Mike and his sons pretty much pulled the trigger on the next one almost immediately. And then we had this three-way bake-off that ran for a few months, where I was in competition with two of my peers to see if I could still win out, which thankfully we did. But the first course by that point was well underway. So that became a constraint. You know, I had to figure out how to get in, around, through, between, next to Bill and Ben's work. And so that added an extra layer of head scratching to figure it all out. But it all came out well in the end.
Well, I know from talking to a few members of the Kaiser family, they said that you had a nice sand ridge that sort of ran through the land where Mammoth Dunes is gone, and obviously there's a good reason why the name Mammoth is on there, because some of them are pretty darn big. But tell us about the opportunity that you had there to go out and really move some golf holes around some elevated areas, and then try to start them and finish them right where they were. I'm sure when you first started working, that clubhouse and that whole area wasn't built yet, so they wanted you to start right there at Ground Central on the resort, and bring the golf course back to finish there as well.
The layout that each of the three parties, or the challenge that Mike gave the three competitors in the bake-off, was pretty unrestricted. He didn't say where the clubhouse should be. He didn't say where the access road should be, or the maintenance, or the lodging, or anything. He just gave each of the three of us all of the land that Bill and Ben hadn't used and said, go for it. Lay out your very best golf course. Don't worry about anything other than the best golf holes. I'm going to decide which of you to pick based purely on the best golf holes. That's it. Nothing else. So I think all three of us laid out golf courses that did not start and finish from the current clubhouse. For those of your listeners that go to Sand Valley, when they get to my third green on Mammoth Dunes, that green was actually my 18th green, and the clubhouse was immediately behind it. And that was the layout that Mike and his two sons selected for Mammoth Dunes, although it wasn't called that yet. And then as we progressed and we tried to figure out how to get access roads in and how to make that layout work, it became apparent that it was going to be tricky to do my layout next to Bill and Ben's layout, because the first tees were a mile apart. So Mike called me up one day and said, okay, I want you to move the clubhouse to where your par 3 fourth hole is. And I want you to redo your layout from there. And I said, okay, Mike, you know, I get that. That's something that happens a lot in my profession where we're, you know, a wrinkle appears and we have to go back to the drawing board. But Mike, in his inimitable style, said, no, you don't understand. I want to move your clubhouse from your behind your third green to take over the piece of land that your fourth green currently sits on. But I want you to leave all the holes where they are, just change the numbers. So that makes it infinitely more complicated. So it took a few visits to go back and scratch our heads and figure out, okay, if 18 becomes 3 and 4 is gone and 5 becomes 1, how do you relay out the golf course? So I know it's complicated to listen to, but that's what happened. The original 18th is now the 3rd. Mm-hmm. And the original 5th is now the 1st. Mm-hmm. Go figure that out.
Well, the first time I was up there, they were doing some limited play once they had, you know, done some work. I was up there before any construction started, but when they had done some work already and they had a few holes open, we went up there. And your crews, I think, were already out working on your golf course, and Ben and Bill had laid out their 18, and I believe about 13 of the holes were open for play. So when I got up there and they gave me the tour, they said, yeah, we've decided that the second course will start and finish at the clubhouse. So that's where I was thinking that they had put that together as the whole plan there originally. David, talk a little bit about your strategy with this golf course. I know that people will say that sometimes with golfers, blind holes can leave a little bit of a love-hate relationship, but you didn't really create blind holes, but it seems like you, in some cases, there's partially blind holes, and you've used that strategy very well there. Can you talk about bringing that to the golf course?
Well, the strategy we had was a little more overarching than just the blind holes. It was really a re-examination of what makes golf fun and enjoyable, and you know what myself and my two associates came to the conclusion of is that golf course architects all too often put themselves in the position of defense and think that the golfers are on offense. And I think that basic logic can be flawed. Quite often the golfer, the average golfer, is just trying to survive. You know, they feel like they're on defense and the whole golf course, the golf ball, the golf club, everything is against them. And so we twisted the dynamic and we said to ourselves, you know, what can we do to make the golfer have more fun? And a fundamental issue, and there's so many of them, but let's take just one. You know, the average golfer has a tough time getting off the tee and getting into a position where he even has a second shot, much less a shot that might be a scoring second shot, just to be able to have a second shot. So what we did at Mammoth was look at ways where we could encourage the average player to get off the tee, give them wide fairways, give them the opportunity to score if he can get into reasonable position, and especially give them the opportunity to recover if he gets himself out of position. And then taking that to another level, if you look at the penalties for a poorly struck shot, something less than perfect, all too often in architecture, the penalty is very black and white, it's binary. So a bad shot ends up in the rough, ends up in the lake, ends up in the bunker. Well, what if we don't make it quite so binary? What if we said, okay, the shot is offline, but you have a slightly obscured view, or you have a slightly uneven lie? Those are penalties that are eminently recoverable from, but they require just a little more skill than they would have done had you been in position A. So those were the kinds of things that we explored in great depth and detail on various courses we've done over the last decade, and Mammoth is the latest iteration of that. And Mike Kaiser got it right away. He first few holes he walked when we were building Mammoth, he said, you know, you're really doing a great job of creating these relatively minor nuisances for me not being in the in a great spot, but with the opportunity of recovery, at least to par, maybe to bogey, but you're certainly taking, you know, doubles and ball and pocket off the table, which really do ruin golf. You know, it makes it no fun at all if you're putting your ball in your pocket after the tee shot. So all of these things were part of why I think the golfing public have responded so well to Mammoth. I mean, I rarely hear golfers who've gone up there not telling me that they've had a really fun time, and you know, their modest golfing abilities have shone, and they felt confident, and they haven't felt stressed on the tee, and they could actually enjoy the game.
Well, David, you know, last year, for the most part, there was a stretch of holes in the middle of the golf course that were not open during the limited play session. And when I got there, the first thing that my two playing partners, and they had never been there before, when I said I had played a little bit of the course the previous year, they said, "Oh, what did you play the boomerang green? What was that like?" And I said, I didn't play the boomerang green. And when I came back from the trip, one of the first things that someone asked me who had played the course earlier this summer said, "What did you think of the boomerang green?" So I will let you tell me how that, I believe it's the sixth hole, that beautiful par four with the boomerang-shaped green came to be, because it certainly has everyone talking about it.
Drivable par fours are super fun. You know, they're the scoring version of a par three. You know, the average golfer thinks they can get there in one, knows they can get there in two, and so they feel like if they don't have at least a birdie putt, you know, they let something slip. So at Mammoth, we've got two drivable par fours, the sixth and the 14th. And on the sixth, right before I built that, I had the opportunity of spending the weekend at Crystal Downs. And their seventh hole is down, caught between two little hillocks. And the green is, you know, can I say moon-shaped, you know, like a half moon. And it's fairly concave, you know, it's like the a quadrant of a NASCAR track. And I thought, oh, this is super cool, you know, and I futzed around on it in the couple of rounds I played to see if I could putt around the arc of that green, and sure enough, you could. And I put it in my memory bank and left. And then I think the next hole I was building at Mammoth was the sixth hole, and it was caught between a couple of ridges. And I said to our shaper on the project, Ernie Polverari, "I've got this idea. You know, I don't want to blow up these two ridges that are here. You know, what if we figured out how to make a highly curved green that we could putt from one side to the other on this drivable par four?" And so we futzed around with it over the course of a week, and the curve got more and more and more severe as we chuckled to ourselves, till eventually, you know, the challenge came. Could we make this thing turn back on itself? I mean, you may call it a boomerang green. It's really a horseshoe. I mean, it completely turned around on itself. And we built the green. We took a basketball out there and we kicked the basketball around to see if we could get it to roll over the hard sand from one side to the other. We just couldn't do it. And we messed around for maybe a day and a half trying to figure out how to get the bank high enough to get the ball to actually climb up the slope and then release all the way around to make a 180-degree turn. And we could not figure it out. And then that night, I think we went back to the house that I'd rented. We're having a couple of beers and barbecuing, and an idea popped into my head on how to actually create it. I was caught up on the whole NASCAR track idea, and I realized that a golf ball is not a car. It doesn't have an engine. And so when the power of the golf ball comes off, it just falls off the wall, if you like. It doesn't have the wherewithal to continue around the high side of the track, if it were NASCAR, to make it to the other side. And so I came up with a solution. Einstein would have been proud. And we went out the next day and we shaped the solution that I had, ran the basketball the first time, and guess what? It made it all the way to the other side time after time. We realized that if golfers were smart enough to figure out how I figured it out, they can do it. You can putt from one side all the way to the other.
Well, I gotta tell you that green was a lot of fun, and the other hole that you mentioned also seems to be getting a lot of conversation in the drivable par four. But a lot of people loving hitting driver and seeing if they can reach the green on number 14. Some people have described it already as the most fun hole on a fun golf course. Tell us a little bit about 14.
Well, it's the second drivable par four. It's on the back. I wanted at least one of the holes to be drivable, and the only way I could ensure that was to do two and make them play a completely opposite, so that whatever the wind is doing, one or other of them is going to be downwind, to give every player a chance. So what's the Achilles heel of a drivable par four? It's that a player who's playing off, you know, maybe the right tee, but doesn't hit it that far. You know, you might have a guy who's a 12 handicap, and he's a reasonably good golfer. He can play to his handicap, but he hits his drive, you know, 220 in the air, 210, something like that. He's playing off the right set of tees at, say, 6,300, 6,400. But a drivable par 4 for him might be 290, 300 yards. Well, he can't hit it that far. So the fun is completely removed for him, because he'll never be able to hit it that far. So again, a challenge appeared. How can I figure out how to get that guy? How do I give him the thrill of a drivable par four that necessitates it being the better part of 300 yards long? Well, what does he have that somebody that can hit it 300 yards maybe doesn't have? He has accuracy. He can maybe hit a slot that's 5 yards wide. So what we did on that hole, and it was actually the hole that a chap called Brian Silvernail won a competition with Golf Digest to collaborate with me on, was we set that hole up so that a bomber can hit it 300 yards and plop it right on the green if he chooses. But an accurate player could hit it 220 and hit to a narrow slot, maybe 10 yards wide on the high side of a fairway bunker. And at that spot, the contours all feed down towards that green if he gets it right. So in that regard, the bomber and the accurate driver can both get on that green. And that, I think, is what makes it so much fun.
David, my two partners came to Wisconsin all the way from Seattle, and part of the reason they picked Wisconsin for their golf trip was the fact they were so influenced and really enjoy a course you did up in the state of Washington called Gamble Sands. And it's my understanding that when the Kaisers saw your work there, it encouraged them to bring you to Wisconsin and have you create Mammoth Dunes. For all of us Midwesterners that haven't been out to the far Northwest and seen Gamble Sands, can you tell us a little bit about that project and the effect that it's had on also bringing you back to work in Wisconsin?
Well, Gamble Sands and Mammoth Dunes are, you know, big brother, little brother. In terms of age, Gamble is 5 or 6 years old now, and Mammoth is barely a one-year-old. As I explained to you earlier, over the last decade or so, myself and my two associates have gone through this real re-examination of the game we love and what we love about it and how we can make it more fun. And Gamble Sands was a project that we did for a farming family that don't really play golf, but they had an amazing site. It was a sandy site on a bluff overlooking the Columbia River down into the gorge. I mean, just breathtaking views, absolutely stunning. And they said, we want you to build something that the people of Seattle will drive 3 hours to come to our beautiful valley and play. So we knew it had to be something not just beautiful and not just challenging, because that just brings a golfer once. I mean, we golfers are notorious on scalping golf courses, buying the bag tag, getting the course guide, never returning. I told the family, coming back more than once is the trick. I can get a bunch of people from Seattle to come the first or second year, but it's really getting them to come year after year. So we built the golf course with the same ethos that Mammoth has, with all on sand, fescue, beautiful views, but it's in the far Pacific Northwest, so it doesn't really get a national audience the way that Mammoth Dunes is likely to get, or Bandon Dunes always gets. Mike Kiger called me up and asked me to do an after-dinner speaking engagement for one of his charities that he's involved in. And I said, Mike, I'd be more than happy to, but this time, because he's asked me a few times to do this sort of thing, I said, this time I have a favor to ask. I really want you to come up to Washington and play the course we just built. And Mike said, okay, and he came up and played it and called me immediately after he came off 18. He said, David, I love it. I think that you've hit a home run. You've returned to the simple, fun ethos of the 20-something that I hired to do Band and Gins. You got it. And what Mike meant was, and this is how I read it, is when I was in my late 20s and I built Band and Gins, it was all on instinct. I didn't understand my craft well enough to articulate it. I just built what was in my gut. And it's taken me, you know, another 15 years to actually articulate that, to understand what it is that makes golf from Scotland, where I'm from, as fun as it is, and understand that the path of architecture in the United States has maybe wandered off course for the last couple of generations. It's not the golf of the pre-World War. You know, I worry that the golf courses that have been created en masse over the last 30 years aren't that much fun for the average golfer. And that is not good. If it's taken 5 hours to play and a half a dozen golf balls and the golfer feels somewhat tired and humiliated, why would he choose to keep doing it? We have to make sure that golf is able to be played at a brisk pace and it's super fun and you desperately want to go do it again. That's the only way our game is going to thrive amongst the masses. Building golf courses that are suitable for tour pros is going to be the death knell of golf if we don't see it soon.
You know, the question's been out there, will there be any additions out at Gamble Sands? Any information from the owners on not only building overnight accommodations, but perhaps another golf course on the property out there?
Well, Gamble Sands is kind of caught in the same trap that Bandon and Sand Valley were caught in, that the owners reacted to quickly, in as much as the golf course is doing really well, but it's highly dependent on rooms because it's remote. So the owners responded and they built 40 beautiful lodges along the river that are absolutely stunning. And those are full. The golf course is doing really well. So now they need more golf and more lodging in order to meet that demand. And maybe most of all, there's the Kaiserism of, you know, one golf course is a fascination, two and more is a destination. And that's where the Gamble Sands owners are at. They need to do a second course. And as of earlier this year, after long chats about whether it was good or not good for me to do it, the family persuaded my associates and I that we should do the second course. So we have that all laid out, and we're waiting on the trigger to get pulled to start building the second course, which I'm hoping will be next summer. In the meantime, we're busy making adjustments to the driving range at Gamble Sands and getting ready to build a par 3 course. We already built a putting course in front of the lodges. So there's lots of activity. The course is doing really, really well. I was there last week with friends from Hawaii. They were stunned. The place is beautiful. I think Gamble Sands is the finest fescue golf course on planet Earth that I've ever seen. As a Scotsman who played all of his golf on the classic courses of the British Isles, I've never seen one in better condition than Gamble Sands is right now. The fescue there is exactly what fescue golf courses should be. It's firm, it's fast, it's wall-to-wall fescue. It's complete. It's absolutely amazing. You can putt from 100 yards out if you wish to. So I would highly recommend anyone that wants a real authentic links experience on fescue, Gamble Sands is right up there.
David, finally, let me ask you, what's next for you? Is outside of anything you might do at Gamble Sands, is there another project on the drawing board? Where else can we look to find the next project by David Kidd?
Well, we're working on a few design projects right now. I'm not sure which will hit the ground first. We're in initial design work with the Kaiser family on a few hush-hush projects right now. That hopefully we get to do in the coming few years. We're working with a few existing clubs, helping them remodel and renovate their existing courses. We're working overseas on a number of projects. So the docket looks pretty good. I think that with the success of Gamble and Mammoth Dunes, we should get more than our fair share of projects moving forward as owners and developers realize that that model of golf is extremely appealing to golfers. So wherever we can find a good site to lay that ethos down on, I'm positive that it will fill up with golfers who just enjoy the game.